So as we're just a couple of hours from the conclusion of the Tisha B'Av fast, I appreciate your patience in staying. In repeated discussions with my wife, Leah, who's been a psychotherapist for many years, she's often remarked to me that the quintessential hallmark of emotional maturity is the ability to tolerate ambivalence. Not only is the tendency to forge rigid, inflexible categories that place everything into right and wrong, black or white choices, characteristic of a much earlier developmental stage, you're really talking about early childhood, it's often also a sign of a certain core insecurity for people. Because we cannot stand the unresolved, the tension of competing realities or truths, the mixed picture, we would prefer to force certainty, however illusory or damaging. It feels far preferable to living with the ambivalence of reality. And in the course of these conversations, my wife introduced me to the work of W.R.D. Fairbairn. Ronald Fairbairn was a very influential psychoanalyst who was born and lived and worked in Scotland and published his central works from the 1930s through to the 1950s. And in a paper he published in 1952, Dr. Fairbairn writes the following: "It is better to be a sinner in a world ruled by God than a saint in a world ruled by the devil." I'm going to say that again. It is better to be a sinner in a world ruled by God than a saint in a world ruled by the devil. And Fairbairn continues and says, "A sinner in a world ruled by God may be bad, but there's always a certain sense of security to be derived from the fact that the world around is good. God is in his heaven, all's right with the world." End quote. Fairbairn expresses the emotional reality of a child whose world of authority, sustenance, and nurturance is run by the adults in his or her life. And so in the face of harsh or neglecting or simply unpredictable treatment by those very adults, that child, in his childish, black and white conception of things, must choose, so to speak, who is to be thought the bad one here? Me, myself, the child, or the parental world around? And the child chooses himself. Why? Because this allows them to feel, firstly, a modicum of security, even if it is illusory, that the ones who are running things, who have power over him, mean well and know what they are doing. Otherwise, the world feels very frightening, unstable, and insecure. And secondly, it allows the child the illusion of personal control. If I decide that I am bad, then I can have the hope that if I act better, then things will go better for me. I can therefore have some control over my parental world around. Thus, in order to survive, the child turns himself into the sinner and holds on to the age-appropriate fantasy that his parents are, so to speak, gods, because the alternative is simply intolerable. To live in a dangerous and terrifying world ruled by the devil, where there's simply no safety and no hope and no control, is an impossible scenario. If the loving and concerned parent is a myth, the trauma would be too overwhelming. The disappointment, self-shattering for the child. But what is the price to be paid for this adaptation of childhood? Does this childhood solution continue through adulthood and dominate all of one's emotional relationships? And the answer is yes. For in order to change the model of I am all bad and the other is all good, the child must mourn. She must grieve the deep feelings of sadness and anger and disappointment, of insecurity and of loss, that resulted from, at its minimum, being raised by unpredictable parents. It would mean accepting that I, as a child, was in fact blameless and powerless, and that therefore it is the adults who raised me who are not comprehensible in their treatment of me. And although obviously there cannot be a one-to-one correlation between Fairbairn's discussion of children and their parents to our discussion of human beings and God, it's not that simple, I bring it here to make a crucial point about what people do when they're presented with what feels inscrutable to them. The quest to make sense of what frequently seemed to be an unpredictable God and the strategies that were thus employed to cope will be our focus here. We all know that much of Jewish religious discourse at this time of the year understandably focuses on the destruction of the two temples, the eradication of the ancient system of sacrifice, the loss of sovereignty. But in light of Fairbairn's words, it would seem that there's perhaps a more central, more fundamental issue that's put into sharp relief by the tragedies that have befallen Jewry down through the ages. The covenant between God and the Jewish people is an agreement, and the agreement is based on mutual promises and expectations, a kind of contract that God makes with the Jews. The covenant holds out a very basic promise. If you do good, you'll receive the good. If you carry out a righteous life in which you adhere to God's commandments, then parts of the Bible promise rewards of longevity and prosperity, and in the wake of the destruction of the temple, the rabbis of the Talmud encountered head-on the possibility that the contract does not follow a predictable pattern, that behavior might not be recompensed in the way they had expected. And that is the real trauma of the destruction. And it raises fundamental questions. Has God, as it were, held up his end of the bargain? How do human beings reconcile their understanding of what is promised by God in this contract and the events that actually take place in history? And you can think of this macro history, or you can think of it as your own personal history. How do we sustain this relationship? How do we trust it? How do we make sense of it? How do we maintain faith in the face of ambivalence? It was nothing less than this fork in the road that faced the rabbis living during and after the destruction, and for us in the shadow of the crematoria, their dilemma is ours as well. So I'd like to explore this dilemma a bit further with you, initially through the work of the contemporary Jewish philosopher, Rabbi Dr. David Hartman, Professor Emeritus at Hebrew University. So if you've come in just now, you'll need the sheets that are on the back table, the sources. In his 1985 work, A Living Covenant, Dr. Hartman lays out the parameters of the quandary very clearly. According to Torah, the God of Sinai doesn't simply hand over the responsibility of doing mitzvot to the Jewish people and then wash his hands of the relationship. The Torah is quite insistent that God commits himself to being involved on a permanent basis with the community of Israel. And we know this simply from a cursory reading of Scripture. Enticing rewards are promised for observing mitzvot, and in both Sefer Vayikra and Sefer Devarim, horrifying consequences are listed for transgression. If you look on the first source in the photocopy, one passage that announces these terms of the contract can be found in the second paragraph of Shema, which is recited daily by Jews. And to make things simpler, we'll read everything in English. And it shall come about, if you listen obediently to my commandments, which I am commanding you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul, that he will give the rain for your land in its season, the early and late rain, that you may gather in your grain and your new wine and your oil, and he'll give grass in your fields for your cattle, and you shall eat and be satisfied. Beware, lest your hearts be deceived and you turn away and serve other gods and worship them. For the anger of God will be kindled against you, and he'll shut up the heavens so there will be no rain, and the ground will not yield its fruit, and you will perish quickly from the good land that the Lord is giving you. Now, what rabbinic literature must in fact do is ostensibly move in reverse, from the punishment back to the crime. It's almost like a retroactive syllogism. Here's what I mean. One, the terms of the contract state that the Jewish people will be rewarded if we perform mitzvot and punished if we do not. Two, the events of real life indicate that we have seemingly been punished through the agency of Babylonia or Rome or choose whoever. Three, working backwards, since we've been punished, it must be that we have failed in our commitment and our performance. But is such a conclusion really true? And so Dr. Harmon points out the following in source 2. The Bible and the rabbinic literature attest that Jews fail to find direct, stable, and predictable connections between their behavior, whether as individuals or as a community, and subsequent events. That in and of itself would be traumatic, because it means that the contract is shaken, if not broken. He continues, when meticulous attempts to live up to covenantal responsibilities were followed by unexpected disasters, was it because of some undetectable flaw in apparently exemplary behavior? Was it because of the sins of earlier years or even of previous generations? Skip a line. One cannot ascribe a sense of dignity to people who are burdened by such questions and are unable to handle their understanding of how God responds to their lives. The rabbis were deeply concerned with this problem, as well as anyone should be. In other words, the rabbis did not simply pretend that real-life events had no effect on real-life faith. They weren't willing to rationalize such events. They were tremendously invested in the idea of a covenant, a two-way relationship. They didn't want to believe that God had abandoned the world. We say every day, right? The penultimate bracha before Shema refers to God as one who in his goodness renews every day constantly the work of creation. God's will in this sense is involved on both the micro and macro level of every element in the world. A relationship that was manifested through the glories of nature, creation, through the liberation of a slave people from Egypt, and of course with the giving of a law code that would instruct, often in the minutest of ways, how the people should interact with each other and with God. If you look at source 3, as Hartman sees it, this makes the Churban just that much more painful, he writes. Given, therefore, that the rabbis lived in a universe in which everything was related to a personal God with a spontaneous will, how did the rabbinic tradition educate Jews to sustain commitment to that personal God in spite of the serious gap that developed between their expectations based on the biblical promises and their actual experience? Unpredictable relationships in which one never knows how one will be treated do not leave an individual unscarred. And here, of course, you can hear the resonance of Fairbairn and his talking about the child right here in this text. They are not conducive to the development of spontaneity and feelings of self-worth, especially if one's total sense of personal worth is measured by the perceived responses of the divine covenantal partner to one's actions. That's a good point. If you measured all of your self-worth on how Jews were treated in history, then our self-esteem would be in the gutter. A covenantal religious consciousness is always vulnerable to self-doubt and to feelings of rejection and guilt. When suffering and tragedy have struck without any explanation, once, twice, repeatedly, individuals in the community no longer know what kind of world they're living in. Like Job, they may ask, why do you hide your face and treat me like an enemy? Hartman explains that at its core, the rabbinic response was not rooted in philosophical theology. They weren't interested in complex explanations attempting to construe the mysterious ways of God. Instead, he argues that the rabbis opt for what he calls religious anthropology, as he explains in Source 4. The problem of suffering appears in a different light when the focus is more on its anthropological rather than its theological implications. The question then becomes, how do we respond to events that can call into question our whole identity as God's relational partners? And here I think we get to the heart of the matter. Can we allow ourselves to embrace a personal God knowing that chaos can at any moment invade our reality and arbitrarily nullify all our efforts and expectations? Do we have the strength to open ourselves to a personal God in a world filled with unpredictable suffering? When her child dies, the question a mother faces is less how to explain the logic of God's omnipotence than whether she has the strength and emotional energy to love again. So I'd like to take you forward and take a look at some of the rabbinic responses to suffering, and they're complex, and they allow for various possibilities in writings that understandably actually contradict one another. Some of these texts seem to mirror Fairbairn's depiction of the child preferring to see himself as the sinner. Right, for instance, you could turn to the well-known passage, the one that is endlessly quoted at this time of year, the Gemara in Yoma, that links the destruction of the first temple to the three cardinal sins, right? Avodah Zarah, Hutamim, Arayot, murder, idolatry, sexual immorality, and that of the destruction of the second temple to Sinat Chinam, to groundless hatred, and many is it Tisha B'Av that I have seen these texts quoted. And it would seem that those kinds of passages guide us into some of the psychic territory that Fairbairn alludes to or proclaims. So what do we do? What do those texts do? They say, after we, the Jews, have been slaughtered, we are the bad ones. We've been soundly beaten by two empires, Babylonia and Rome, with all the ensuing images of death and exile and poverty and degradation. And if you think about it, that would mean that this kind of response in the Gemara is remarkably self-critical. Were it not for our sins, the temple would still stand. Now, in part, by way of justification, we can refer, of course, to the central doctrine of chosenness, the belief that what happens to Jews is never an accident and that our material histories are inexorably linked to our moral failings or our moral virtues. So what is seemingly masochistic can also be understood, as Fairbairn explained, as an attempt to exert some control. Because if we are responsible, then we can change matters. We can change history. We can change our faiths. So it's not hard to understand the sort of underlying current of that Talmudic passage. Parenthetically, I would just say, though, that it's that mentality that after we get crushed, we blame ourselves. It was that mentality that caused Richard Rubinstein after the Shoah to break ranks with all previous forms of rabbinic theodicy and to declare on some level the death of God. Because for him, this tactic, this continuous tactic of self-blame after in the face of suffering was too obscene to accept after Auschwitz. At a certain point, he said, enough. We're not playing that card anymore. However, it would be a mistake to think that this is Chazal's only response on how to view these tragedies, because it certainly isn't. You find a vigorous struggle underway in rabbinic texts on how to absorb the fact that divine actions are shockingly unpredictable. One of the more poignant examples actually comes near the end of the first chapter of Tractate Kiddushin. And if you take a look at Source 5, we'll begin there. So here the Mishnah lays out a vision of reciprocity. And it says, he who performs one mitzvah, good is done to him. His days are prolonged, he inherits the land. He who does not perform one mitzvah, good is not done to him. His days are not prolonged, he does not inherit the land. Now, there are a lot of ways of explaining this Mishnah, which I'm not going to get into here. But the Mishnah would seem to reiterate the sentiment that we saw in the second parak of Shema, which is that there's a logical chain of cause and effect between human action and divine response. But the rabbis don't buy into this Mishnah. They object on textual grounds because it's contradicted elsewhere in a very famous passage, really one of the most famous passages of rabbinic grappling with the seeming injustice of the world, and that's in source 6. Now, the passage begins before the one that you've seen on the page with a statement by Rabbi Yaakov, Schar mitzvah b'hayal maleika. There's no reward for a good deed in this world. Right? We'll come back to that statement, but that's the opening shot, so to speak, of the sukkah. There's not a single mitzvah in the Torah whose reward is mentioned alongside it, which is not dependent on the resurrection of the dead for receiving the reward. In connection with honoring parents, it is written that your days may be prolonged and that may go well with you. In reference to the dismissal of the mother bird from the nest, it is written that it may be well with you and that you may prolong your days. Let's pause here for a moment. There are two mitzvot aseh, there are two positive commandments in the entire Torah, which have a rider of reward attached to them in the psukim, and these are it. Honoring your parents and removing the mother bird from the nest if you're going to take the young. If you look in the Torah, those are the two mitzvot that actually have long life associated with them as a reward. So they're actually going out of their way explicitly to tell you, do these things and you're in good. Now, if one's father said to him, ascend to the loft and bring me young birds, the Gemara continues, and he ascends to the loft and dismisses the mother and takes the young, but on his return he falls and is killed. Where is this person's happiness? Where is this person's prolonging of days? So if you stop there with a question of the Talmud, two things occur. First of all, the Talmud is still taking this on a theoretical level. It doesn't actually realize what Rabbi Yaakov is about to tell them, that no, this isn't theory for me. I've seen suffering. And secondly, it's going to pose it as rhetorical questions, but that makes everybody a little uncomfortable, so they're going to try and answer these rhetorical questions by saying, by reinterpreting the verses, to say that it may be well with you means on the day that is wholly good, that your days may be long on the day that is wholly long, in other words, the afterlife. So now, the Talmud begins to investigate. Perhaps there was no such happening. We don't want to talk about theoretical cases of suffering. Why are you bringing this up? So Rabbi Yaakov says he saw an actual occurrence. So now the dialectic continues. Then perhaps the boy was meditating upon a transgression at the moment he fell. Maybe he was thinking of sinful stuff. So now the Talmud actually makes a proclamation about how God operates in the world and says the Holy One, blessed be He, does not treat an evil thought as a corresponding act. Thinking is one thing and doing is another. Perhaps he was meditating idolatry, in which case the thought is enough, right? Because idolatrous thought is equal to bad act. And so on and so forth. So the Talmud says, that too was precisely Rabbi Yaakov's point. Should you think that mitzvot are a reward in this world, why did the mitzvah that he just fulfilled not shield him as a reward from being led to such meditation? If he's doing a mitzvah, God should have blocked out, screened out any thoughts of idolatry, or at least not punished him for it. All right, we're going to pause there. So first of all, there are several things we want to look at here when we're learning this text. First, we have in the position of Rabbi Yaakov an utter refusal to accept that the boy's demise can be seen as rationally explainable by all known categories of dignity and reason. Far from trying to ferret out a secret reason which suggests the boy is culpable, Rabbi Yaakov actually focuses on the child's righteousness, that he's carrying out a mitzvah. Rabbi Yaakov is saying to the reader, children like this should not die in such a fashion. And what this induces in Rabbi Yaakov is something akin to surrender. Hence, our mitzvah by Al Malaika. You won't find joy or fulfilled expectations in this lifetime. Cling to the mitzvot, don't expect a rational recompense, period. That is saved for another dimension in another place. no reward for mitzvah in this world, those words have the force of a gunshot. Because it makes you rethink everything. And another thing is that he does not present the afterlife as some kind of abstract philosophical doctrine. It is rather an anguished hope, a wish for justice in the face of the actual tragedies he has seen. He doesn't suddenly start a philosophical conversation with Beit Midrash and says, you know, Judaism believes in the afterlife. Not at all. It comes as a response to the terrible suffering that he's seen and the hope that there's something on the other end that can make this work, make this equation balance out. But what's interesting further is how the rabbis respond to Rabbi Yaakov, right? Because what he's given them is a real, I would say, a lure, a temptation, right? It's the temptation of a totalized explanation. People love totalized explanations. They like the one thing that'll solve everything for them. Just give me the answer. Right? So Rabbi Yaakov's giving them a little bait here. Well, you know what? Two mitzvot that promise you long life. He does both of them and he dies. Must be schar mitzvah b'chol maleika. And in that, we can eliminate the apparent contradiction in Olam Hazeh between doing good and receiving bad by assigning all reward to Olam Haba. And yet, the rabbis do not automatically gravitate towards this option. And that, to me, is noteworthy. Instead of surrendering to the temptation to rationalize all problems in history by playing the secret card of reward in the hereafter, that's a favorite trick in Jewish education, and not a very impressive one either. Instead of doing that, the rabbis probe for the facts of this world. Maybe the punishment was just on its own terms, so that we don't have any need for any metaphysical maneuvers like the future but unknowable rewards of heaven. Maybe the boy sinned, at least in his thoughts, or had visions of idolatry, a cardinal sin. But it's interesting that at the same time as they don't want to play the afterlife card, they're also equally unwilling to simply disregard common sense. So at least in this case, the case of a single boy on a ladder trying to do a mitzvah, we go with what we see. We don't create insidious and false rumors about this child. We don't posit hypothetical bad Jewish behavior just to satisfy our theological categories, to make it all fit. In other words, do not reinterpret good behavior as bad action. We can tell the difference. In the end, there's also a further piece. For those of you who have two pages, it's on the second page, and for those of you who have the double-sided, turn it over. Pretty interesting end to this sugya. Rebbe Lazar said, those who are sent on a mitzvah are never harmed, right? Because we have this principle in Jewish life that if you're on your way to do mitzvah, harm won't come to you. Then when they're on their way, it is different. But Rebbe Lazar said, those who are sent on a mitzvah are never harmed either on their way or on the return, right? He tried to stick in one little more abstruse argument before he throws it out and says, no, period. He shouldn't have had bad things happen to this child. What's the story? It was a rickety ladder. So that injury was likely, and where injury is likely, one must not rely on a miracle. Now, Dr. Hartman calls this the attempt to retain the promised unity between mitzvot and the material conditions of reality. In other words, God's love shouldn't be dismissed or disbelieved just because the ladder collapsed. Maybe it's our fault. Right? As Cassius famously tells us in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, the fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves. So do not blame God, asserts Rebbe Lazar, for the breakdown of certain human situations. God will not necessarily protect us from reckless behavior or from things which we didn't properly attend to or things we didn't properly prepare. So it's true, the child may be faultless when he ascends to the nest, but that won't save him from a rickety ladder that's collapsing. So ends the passage. I know there are people who are satisfied with this ending. I'm not one of them. Is it enough, really, to make sense of the absurd, the ludicrous, the tragic? So the picture is obviously mixed. On the one hand, why can't God, the God who liberated the slaves, the God who defeated the enemies of Israel, protect one righteous boy? On the other hand, the rabbis warn, look, you have to approach reality with caution and with your eyes wide open. So it's this mixed picture, right? This ambivalence. A sense that life and Judaism are profoundly gray, not black and white, not clear cut, not this or that, can be intolerable for some people. If you look in Source 7, Dr. Harmon writes, some find the unpredictable dimensions of reality to be so overwhelming that they cannot bear the strain of not knowing whether God loves them or has turned away from them. Theism gives them the feeling that to live religiously is to be doomed to remain psychologically a manic depressive. For them, suffering is bearable if it results from the limitations of finite human beings, but it becomes terrifying and demonic if it is seen as part of the scheme of their all-powerful creator. Others would find life unbearably chaotic if they could not believe that suffering or tragedy and death were part of God's plan for the world. Feeling that there is meaning and order in the world, and that God in his wisdom decided to terminate the life of their loved one, makes their tragedy bearable, to which I would add, or not. His thesis in the book is that generally, Judaism contains an inherent tension between assertion and submission. He argues that there are features in the tradition, and I think he's 100% right, that encourage Jews to manifest what he calls a sense of adequacy, dignity, and initiative in their covenantal relationship with God. We have certain examples we can point to. Throughout the Tanakh and Talmud, just a few, Avram querying about the fate of Sodom with God, right? In Perek Yudchet of Bereshit. Moshe negotiating after the Chet Ha'egel, after the golden calf. And famously, the Gemara in Baba Metzia, in which a bat kol, a voice from heaven, is rejected in favor of majority rule, lo b'shamayim hi. I'm going to return to that in just a minute. The Torah is no longer in heaven. But the thing is, as we know, there are other passages. Unpredictable, shocking, incomprehensible, where the paradigm is the reverse. In those instances, writes Hartman, the God of the covenant is experienced in ways that inspire awe, silence, resignation. The dominant trope there is submission, surrender, or even terror. I've given you a sample of such passages here in 8 and 9. Of course, the story in Parsha Shmini, with Nadav and Avihu, who take Esh Zarah, are trying to serve their God, and are consumed instantly on the altar. The story in Shmuel Aleph, where God kills the men of Beit Shemesh because they looked into the Aron, talking about 50,000 people plus die. And the death of Uzzah, right, when they come to the threshing floor, and the oxen almost tip over the Aron, and he, trying to do the right thing, tries to balance the Aron, boom, gone. And so on and so forth. And then, of course, the Gemara in Menachot, which I didn't put down here, regarding the fate of Rabbi Akiva, who is so astonishing in his scholarship, right, that Moshe Rabbeinu can't even follow his lesson, and then asks to see what is the reward of this great man, and God, almost in kind of movie form, shows him a vision of Rabbi Akiva being flayed alive by the Romans. So how are we to rely upon or estimate God's behavior in light of seeming arbitrariness and violent death? So you have, in the Gemara, in life, this contrast between covenantal adequacy and bewildered submission. I don't really think that's a sign of inconsistency, by the way. That's how it is. Life is ambivalence and it's struggle. There are parts of God's plan for history that are simply unintelligible to human beings. And nothing that anyone says here or elsewhere is going to change that fact. What I would argue here, though, is that the emergence of two seemingly different, even opposite responses to suffering and to life are in fact at least partly generated by the exact same need to cope with insecurity about the unknown. They seem completely different on the surface, but if you look at what's driving them emotionally, they're almost identical. What do I mean? So, in the modern world, two ostensibly conflicting developments. Autonomy, fundamentalism. Yet they are somehow strangely linked. On the one hand, you have by now the well-rehearsed post-Enlightenment rejection of traditional religion in favor of absolute and unbridled autonomy. And this has had some pretty momentous byproducts, one of them being a loss of community and of any feeling that we belong to something larger or can point to a larger vision, you know, besides consumer consumption and endless remakings of our identities. One of the best articulations, actually, of this turn inward in the modern world is from the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, who connects the nearly hardwired preference for individualism today with the dominant mentality that we cannot abide by the imposition of religion's claims on our time, on our bodies, on our freedoms. So that is part of the impulse towards being autonomous. It involves the throwing off of any external constraints, religion being a primary example of such constraints. Here's the way Taylor puts it. In principle, people are no longer sacrificed to the demands of supposedly sacred orders that transcend them. But everybody in this room knows that this newfound freedom that we've all got does not come without a price, which is a kind of inchoate but very profound dislocation. So as many of us suspect, even as we reject the dictates of some external morality or pretend that we don't, but we do, it was these same restrictive codes and systems that gave meaning to the world. So though autonomy by one measure has been very liberating, one senses that this all-encompassing passion for independence, the idea that nobody tells me what to do, is also the flip side of actually disappointment. Why? Because it's an inoculation. If I'm freed from everything and everyone and all systems, it's an inoculation against being let down yet again by what were the original vehicles of meaning, God, authority, religion. And ironically, it could be the very same emotional factor which is in play for the diametrically reverse process, which is the move currently in many religions, including Judaism, towards a fundamentalist picture of certainty and a defiant kind of strictness, as though we'll tame or seduce or immunize ourselves against both the modern world and the silence or inscrutability of God with the meticulousness of our devotion. But, as in Fairbairn's scenario of the child, this too can become a maladaptive strategy with its rigidity and its desire to force black and white where only gray exists. What will inevitably result is a breakdown of truth, a stunting of genuine emotional maturity, and perhaps most problematically, an outlook which is grounded in suspicion and the anticipation of loss. And at its worst, this manifests in an inability to reach out and love that which is different from you, and to engage with openness and without fear. The bottom line is that all extremes are telling. All extremes are telling. Too much license, too much restriction, playing in the same emotional sandbox. And when one turns to certain strands in rabbinic thought, there's also duality that's brought on by the need to deal with the aftermath of God's unpredictable patterns in history. So whether the texts we've been discussing so far advocate that Jews should react to tragedy by engaging in submissive self-criticism, or whether they confidently proclaim that Judaism is now in the hands of the rabbis and that interpretive autonomy is the order of the day, perhaps a similar psychological process is at work. So let's turn to the last source, source 11, and read it. The source begins with a rather obscure argument about Tanur Achnai, the serpentine oven, and it's an obscure point of Jewish law about whether the oven receives impurity. It's dependent on whether it's considered one unit or considered separate units with tiles and sand intermixed. That's not our issue here, but what ensues is an enormous argument. Between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, and on that day we're told Rabbi Eliezer brought forward every imaginable argument and they did not accept them. Now, Rabbi Eliezer's understanding of truth is that if I can bring reality to back up my intellectual arguments, I'm right. Because reality should count for something. So he says to them, if the law is as I say, let this carob tree prove it, right? So be magical. And the carob tree was torn 100 cubits out of its place, and some say 400. But interestingly, reality has no sway, has no truck in this Beit HaMidrash, and they say back to him, no proof can be brought from a carob tree. So he says to them, well, if the law is as I say, let this stream of water prove it. And the stream of water flowed backward. No proof can be brought from a stream of water, they rejoined. And again, he argued, if the law is as I say, let the walls of the schoolhouse prove it. And the walls began to fall, and Rabbi Yoshua rebukes the walls, a little humor in the middle of the passage. So what are you falling when scholars are debating? So there's a sort of permanent triangular shape of the wall. Now, at this point, Rabbi Eliezer are obviously quite frustrated because, after all of us in arguments usually feel that, you know, we've got the facts on our side. Life is proving what we're saying, experience, but they don't accept it. They seem somehow obstinate in the face of this. So he says, if the law is as I say, let it be proof from heaven. Whereupon a heavenly voice cried out, why do you dispute with Rabbi Eliezer? Seeing that in all matters of law, it is as he says, right? He's right. For sure he's right. God says he's right. But Rabbi Yeshua rose and exclaimed, Lo b'shamayim, he that is not in heaven. What did he mean by this? Said Rabbi Yirmiyahu. That the Torah had already been given at Mount Sinai, we pay no attention to heavenly voice. Interesting. We pay no attention to a heavenly voice in Sinai. True? Because you have long since written of the Torah, after the majority one must incline. And the coda to the passage, Rabbi Natan met Eliyahu and asked him, right, they're having a discussion up in Shemayim, what did the Holy One, blessed be He, do at that moment? He replied, laughing, saying, in the original, Nitzchuni Banai, my sons have defeated me, my sons have defeated me. I have always been very curious about the Gemara that celebrates Lo B'Shamayim He. When you see it's discussed very often, correctly, as an affirmation of rabbinic authority, the joy of rabbinic exegesis, the power that's now entrusted in the rabbis to interpret and move forward Judaism. It's ours now. You gave us this baby, we're going to move it forward. But if you look at the end of the passage, the end of the passage seems lighthearted, congratulatory, my children have defeated me, God laughs. But you can't help but be struck by this insistent blocking of divine agency, by the rabbi's stubborn refusal to let God back into the process. Beneath this insistence of siding with the majority opinion, in the name of keeping the rules and maintaining halachic consistency, lies a hint of defiance. As though to say to God, you left us to our own devices. You opted out of communication. You stayed mute in the face of our enemy's wrath. So we are not willing to wager a guess on when you, God, decide you want to be involved, or when you, God, will just suddenly decide to abdicate. Frankly, it's just a lot safer for us to do it this way. In other words, lo b'shamayim, he may also be a form of emotional as well as halachic self-protection. But at the very same time, and this is what I think is the genius of the passage, lo b'shamayim, he may also be a subtle way of letting God back in, even as he's been thrust out. Why? Look at the words that the Gemara ascribes to God at the end. They're very resonant. Nitzchuni banai. Nitzchuni, in the Strander translation, is my children have defeated me. Right? Because Netzach means victory or triumph. But Netzach also means eternity. As though what the rabbinic God is really saying, in quite a self-congratulatory flourish on Chazal's part, you have made me eternal. You, the rabbis, have made me God eternal. In the wake of the destruction, where the rabbis search for a method of staying in contact with God while remaining wary of how to maintain such a volatile relationship, the appropriation of Jewish learning becomes the primary way of keeping the flame alive. In making God eternal, but on their own terms, the rabbis cautiously begin the arduous task of learning to live with God and without him at one and the same time. In appropriating lo b'shamayim he for their own purposes, the rabbis have renegotiated the contract, redefined the covenant. The question was no longer, does God keep his promises, but rather, how can we best develop a religious outlook which will allow, both for faith in God and inner integrity, trust in the unseen and self-assertion? And that's the paradox. To be with and yet without. To trust and yet to self-protect. To venture forward, yet to look over one shoulder. To commit, and yet to hedge. That's the challenge, that's the warning of ambivalence. Perhaps what we're all striving for is balance, or as my wife likes to say, integration. Can we as individuals and as communities integrate both the necessity of autonomous thought as well as the vital discipline of rules and structures? Can we develop a healthy ability to self-criticize without diminishing our own value? Can we incorporate God without being either self-punitive or disingenuously pious? Can we balance off confidence in our religious identities without denigration of the other? We as Jews have been grappling with these questions and problems for quite some time now. We cannot control, nor even fully grasp, whether God keeps his promises, nor do we or can we fully understand what it means for us to live up to or conversely to fail God's expectations. If, it's a big if we can tolerate the uncertainty that comes now and forever with these unresolved issues, we can, with God's help, become a more loving, less judgmental, more inspiring community. And if we cannot tolerate such ambivalence, we will tend to grow harsher in our religious outlooks, more judgmental, and more formulaic in the teaching of our children. We are told, Hashemayim Shamayim LaHashem, Va'aretz Natan Livnei Adam. The heaven is the heaven of the Lord, and the earth was given to human beings. But as for the Torah, if it is not in heaven, it is also not quite on earth either. Religion is the space between heaven and earth. It's the space that we inhabit when we pray, and when we learn, and when we fast. It's neither here nor there. It's in between. It allows us to encounter the deepest things and then return to the earth, so to speak, with a renewed commitment towards making things better. To know what to keep and what to relinquish. To give up on illusions that are not my portion and to embrace the life that is mine. And to do all of this with an awareness of time passing, because time is passing. what the British novelist Kazuo Ishiguro so eloquently termed the remains of the day. That is, the liberation that comes with renouncing the inessential and getting to what matters. May we all be so blessed, and may the growth that results hasten the Gula.